Good morning, everyone. I think there are going to be others joining us, but it's good if we make a start. And it's really great to see you all here this morning and to be here ourselves. I've known Dr. Evelyn Sharp for, I was working it out last night, 20 years. We actually met at Bible College, and we were from what was my previous home church, still Evelyn's home church, and we lived together. And she knows one of the many things I appreciate about her is that sense of balance, and that's very much reflected in her work, because Evelyn's a consultant psychiatrist with a London hospital via the NHS, but also works with a Christian organisation that is medically orientated. So it's really great to have you here this morning, and I'm going to pray and then hand over to Evelyn. Lord, we just really praise you and thank you that we're here this morning before you. And we do pray that everything of this morning will work towards each of us having a better understanding of depression and very much seeing you in focus as we look at that. So we pray that you would strengthen Evelyn and help us to really receive all that you would give to us through this morning. For your namesake and glory, Lord. Amen. Okay, so thank you.
Thanks, Terry. Okay, it's good to be here, and appreciate that you've all given up a Saturday morning to come, and I hope that this will be of use to you. I've been a psychiatrist for over 20 years and still learning about depression, so I don't think we're going to cover it all this morning, and you may still have some questions. I'm assuming you will have questions still when you leave, but I hope there'll be questions that are perhaps better informed and will lead you in the right direction. I may refer to several books and information and so on. If you want more information, there'll be a sheet at the end of resources and books and so on that you can each take, so you'll have that to refer to. And I'm kind of trying to look at depression from various angles, as you'll see, whether is it a sickness? Is it a social problem? Is it a spiritual problem? Or is it all three? And that's probably the conclusion I will come to, it's a mixture of all three things. It's very common in our society today. Depression is well recognized. It's in popular magazines. It's discussed a lot on TV. It's said that 1 in 10 people probably suffers from depression or will suffer from it in their lifetime, and that by 2020 it will be the second most expensive disease in the world. It's second only to cardiovascular disease in terms of costs throughout the world. It's commoner in women, at least that is recognized as perhaps more common in women than in men, although it exists in men too. And chronic depression can also be a problem, that of those who get depressed, maybe again another 10% or more will go on to have a kind of either a problem that recurs or that persists at a lower level for throughout a lifetime. So it's quite a big impact on people's individuals' lives, but also on our society. Why is it so common? Is it a real increase? Or is it that there has been an increased medicalization? This book came out just last year called The Loss of Sadness, which argues that we are over-defining depression, since we're making it, confusing it with normal sadness, and that therefore there's not really so great an increase. But if you look at the summary of depressive symptoms, you'll see that, in a sense, they do overlap with other conditions. This is from what is sometimes called the Bible of psychiatry, but it's not infallible like the Word of God. But it's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Diseases from the US. And this is the summary of depressive symptoms. And in order to qualify for a diagnosis of depression, you have to have five, at least, of these, and one of which must be either depressed mood or diminished interest in life or pleasure in enjoyment in things. And there's one kind of one main caveat about this diagnosis, these symptoms. They must not be related to a bereavement, at least within the previous 2 months. So bereavement reactions are often very similar to depressive reactions, but if you've had the bereavement happening 2 months before then, it doesn't qualify for a diagnosis of depression. That's the formal kind of diagnostic criteria. There's another one called the ICD-10, which is fairly similar. It's one that's mostly used in the UK, but the DSM-4 tends to be used clinically. The ICD-10 is one that's used for research purposes. But not everyone who's depressed presents with these classical symptoms. Not everyone comes along saying, I feel low, or I've lost interest in life, or nothing gives me pleasure anymore, or I can't concentrate, doctor, or psychomotor retardation is just slowing up. People who are depressed often are slower about doing everything, or they can have an agitated state of mind. So you can either have those, or they say, I can't sleep, or I'm sleeping too much, I don't want to lift my head out of the covers in the morning, and as soon as I can, I go back to bed and stay there the rest of the day. And a change in appetite, again, either I've lost my appetite in food, or I'm eating all the time because it's the only thing that gives me some sense of comfort. But there are other symptoms that can also present. Some cultures don't recognize psychological illness in the same way as Western society. That has had quite a lot of input from psychological theories over the last 100 years. We tend to sometimes more easily talk in psychological terms. But that doesn't mean that depression isn't present. It is recognized in practically every culture in the world, but it sometimes presents in different ways. And even here, perhaps more often again in men who may not find it easy or to acknowledge or talk about their emotions, they may present with physical symptoms. Sometimes it's a sense of shame, a sense of guilt. Sometimes it's because depression causes physical symptoms and a person will present with those to their doctor rather than the depressed mood. And it's only when tests don't show anything else, or if the doctor or nurse or is alert, that they may pick up that this is actually a depression. And people who are depressed may try to deal with it in unhelpful ways. They may think, well, may start to drink more. They may use sex more. They may, in an attempt to feel better, or sometimes it's a loss of interest in sex, and that creates relationship problems. Sometimes the depression itself causes relationship difficulties, and that's the presenting issue. Depressed people may be angry and not know how to deal with it. Sometimes feeling aggressive, things like taking time off work for no good reason. Mothers who become depressed may often find difficulty bonding with their children, and that may be the presenting symptom, say, to the midwife or and home health visitor. I really expected to love my child, but I don't. What's wrong with me? Or is there something wrong with this baby? What happened? And that may be an indication that there's actually a postnatal depression happening. As I said, men, sometimes it's for certain groups there is the difficulty of facing, acknowledging depression. And then we come on to kind of how depression is treated in the medical world. This is my field, in a sense, in the medical field. This is the way it's looked at, that you move from treating it in primary care up to inpatient treatment, in a psychiatric unit. And in primary care, you go to your GP. They might not immediately start, if they diagnose depression, start giving you antidepressants. They may say, look at lifestyle, suggest you take some exercise, because exercise can be helpful, particularly to reduce anxiety, not so much to actually treat depression, but they may say, look at that. They may, if you are in the right area and there's access to it, may be referred for a therapy called CBT, or cognitive behavior therapy. NICE, the organization that you may have heard of, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, that kind of decides what treatments should be paid for, which treatments should be advocated on the NHS. are very strong, very keen on CBT for the initial treatment of depression and anxiety. And the problem is, of course, that there aren't enough therapists trained in CBT to give it, so it's very, it can be quite difficult to access. But it is what's proposed. And then antidepressants. Most people will have heard of the ones that are commonly used are the are a group called the SSRIs. That's usually what they're referred to as, which stands for Selective Serotonin Reuptake Inhibitors. You may not want to remember, but that's they, because they increase a level of a chemical in the brain called serotonin. And nobody knows actually quite exactly how it works. The theories have changed even since when I was a medical student. There was one theory, and now the theory has altered quite a bit in the sense that it may be that increasing the level of these chemicals within the brain allows certain brain cells that have either closed off or shut down or maybe even died off to regrow, reactivate, and that can then improve in certain areas of the brain that are to do with mood and to do with sleep and to do with appetite and so on, that they, if they reactivate, life gets back to normal within the brain and then within in the person. And that may explain why it's sometimes a bit of a delay. And if you prescribe, if people are prescribed antidepressants, the prescriber will often say, these won't work straight away. You need to give them 2 weeks, 3 weeks, sometimes even longer to work, because it's not the chemical in them that, in a sense, improves the mood. It's what it does to the brain cells and allows them to reactivate. So SSRIs, Prozac, and its relations, in a sense, are the ones that are often the most commonly used, particularly at the first line of treatment. And apologies for my pronunciation, but I was interested to find out that, the Chinese name for Prozac, which is Bai Yuji, means undoer of all kinds of sorrows. So Prozac is the answer to everything. Some people, well, certainly in the drug company's mind, they'd like us to believe that, but it's not always true. When you move up to the next level, in a sense of if depression doesn't respond at that primary care level, then the next level is perhaps to change antidepressants, to use other antidepressants that have a double mode of action that affect other chemicals in the brain besides serotonin, to introduce other drugs like mood stabilizers or even antipsychotics for some kinds of depression where there is what's called a psychotic element, where people begin to believe things that aren't true, really believe them, like believe. In depression often, when it's very severe, people believe things like they're rotting away inside, their body is dying, or that they've committed a terrible crime, they're responsible for the bad things that are happening in the world, and they can't be argued out of it. And that kind of psychosis often needs an addition of an antipsychotic medication as well as an antidepressant. And in cases of depression that don't respond even to antidepressants, or where there's a threat to life, a really serious physical threat where people stop eating and drinking, that can be very severe depression can result in that, or very severely suicidal patients, sometimes electroconvulsive therapy or ECT is still used and it can be very effective. But that would be a hospital treatment that is used sometimes when other treatments haven't worked. So this is that's the kind of medical model, and it's also what we use sometimes in a self-help way. One of the things about CBT that makes it very popular, I think, is that it's amenable to a self-help approach. So it's cheaper if you can tell people to get people to do it yourself, but it's also sometimes helpful to people that, to know that they can do something themselves. And this is a magazine article that looks at a kind of CBT approach. And it's the same magazine article where this man, where Stephen Fry talks about his depression. And he, I don't know if many of you saw his TV program, but in that he says that although he suffered quite badly from depression at times, he tries not to use medication. He would prefer not to use it if he can. But he talked to some other people who did use it and found it helpful. But this article particularly was looking at the CBT approach. And just to talk a little bit more about what CBT is about. I don't know if you can see that. CBT, the theory in a sense is that altered mood is a result of difficulties or unhelpful ways of thinking that result in unhelpful feelings. And that if you can alter the way that you think, you can then alter the way that you feel. And that sometimes that is you helping people to identify their unhelpful reactions, their unhelpful thoughts, and that will lead to an improvement in their mood. So you don't, in a sense, directly attack the mood, or you look at the thoughts behind it. And this suggests that perhaps a practical problem or a relationship difficulty leads to altered thinking patterns, unhelpful thoughts, which alter the way that the person feels, both physically and emotionally. And then in response to that, they behave differently. They withdraw, they go to bed, they drop out of their normal activities. And that then leads to further unhelpful thinking because they feel they're no use or they're not able to do anything, and reinforcing the cycle. And that if you can help people break into that or break through that, then they will change. And for, say, an example, it might be a woman has cooked a nice meal for the family. And first of all, her teenage son rings up and says, "Mom, I'm not coming home for dinner. I'm staying at my friend's and I want tea." Then her husband comes in and she says, "I've got dinner." He says, "Well, actually, I had a business lunch today and I'm not really hungry." And she looks at the dinner. And instead of throwing the plate at her husband and saying, "You know, why didn't you tell me?" she says, "Oh, that just goes. They don't like my cooking. They don't like me. They don't love me. I'm useless. I'm no good." And feels depressed. And her husband's thinking, "What was that about?" Or, you know, "She won't tell me." Or, "He doesn't know what he's done. She doesn't tell." And she puts it into herself. And that leads to depression. That's the kind of scenario, perhaps, that might be one that would result in a depressive type of reaction. And CBT is designed to help someone, that woman or another, identify within themselves in situations that happen in their life how those unhelpful reactions and thoughts, and to then challenge them and say, "Well, does it? Well, actually, that didn't mean that. It was my son often stays at friends. I could have recognized that. My husband should have phoned me. I could have told him that he should have phoned me and asked him to do it the next time. The dinner was fine. It wasn't my fault." You know, so that, to try and change that, it's sometimes it's relatively easy, sometimes it's very difficult, because those patterns of thinking may not just come from the here and now, but may be related to how a person has grown up and beliefs they have about themselves. If they have always been told, "You're useless, you'll never amount to anything," then when things go wrong, they may think, "Well, that reinforced, there you are, I'm useless, just tell you," or, "You'll never do anything well." So those old patterns, or if you like, ingrained patterns of thinking, can be reinforced by events. And so it's not always easy to challenge them, and it takes sometimes quite a lot of hard work. So although a self-help approach can be used, sometimes it's easier if you do it with someone else who can help you to identify those things. So roughly that's kind of a quick summary or look at what CBT is. And I think that as Christians, we do recognize that what we think matters, and how we think about things matters, and that sometimes we need to change our ways of thinking and get them more in line with what God's word says about us, about what we are, who we are in Christ. And those kind of things have to be real. They're not just a theory, but they have to be real in our experience and in the way we react to what happens in our lives. So I think that CBT has a truth about it. It's not the answer to everything, and it's not the whole truth, but it has a truth about it. And there is one book that is on the list called "I'm Not Supposed to Feel Like This," which is a Christian CBT approach that is has got a lot of both sort of biblical stuff and psychological stuff intertwined to help people who are Christians use this approach to depression. As I mentioned, childhood experiences can lay down the track or the for a later onset of depression. And there are others, other high-risk groups who may develop, who are known to be more likely to develop depression. People who are socially isolated, people with relationship difficulties, people who've had depression in the past, that increases your risk of having another depressive episode. If there's a family history, it doesn't mean that you inevitably will have depression, but it increases the likelihood. Bad events in life, and we'll look at some of those in a moment. Physical illness, people who've got chronic physical illness, chronic pain, people with some other physical conditions, heart disease, for example, are more at risk of developing depression. You mean women after childbirth. A lot of street drugs and alcohol are depressants. They are, and eventually their use will can lead to depression. And it can be quite hard for people who've given up drugs and alcohol to recover. The depression can persist for a lot longer than they would like, and it can be a difficult thing when people have given up using alcohol or given up using drugs to then battle with a depression that persists. Older men and interesting people who go into care homes, whether it's because they go into care homes because they're already isolated and have nowhere, no family or little social support, or because when they're there, they feel life hasn't got much more for them, but they're a group that are at risk. And I remember going to a travel medicine conference and learning something I hadn't really realized, that cruise ships, cruise holidays are not a good place to go if you're feeling depressed or feeling lonely, that they have quite a high rate of people presenting with depression and even with suicide on cruise, because they're older people, often lonely, and there's nowhere more lonely in a sense than in the middle of a crowd of people who appear to be having a good time and having friendships. So if you're depressed, don't go on a cruise. Sometimes there are, as I said, life events that tend to increase the risk of a depressive illness occurring. Common one is after a baby is born for women, but there are also others, things like serious injury or assault, death of a close family member, breakdown of relationship, losing a job, financial crisis, police or court appearances. And a common thread in many of these things is the theme of loss. I know I said earlier that depression shouldn't be diagnosed if someone has recently had a bereavement, but often in when someone presents with depression, you will find that there has been, in the past, fairly recently, not necessarily a close bereavement, but something that has threatened that person's sense of security or their relationships, either an actual loss or, as I say, a threat of a loss. And so for some people, it may be something small like their cat dying. You think, no big deal. But that may be the last in a series of losses, perhaps going back to childhood, and that is the trigger. For a high-flying financier, a dent in his Ferrari might actually trigger, in a sense, a depression, because it is the loss of something that he had aimed for. And quite often, depression will come after success. Sometimes people become successful, achieve what they wanted, and then get depressed. And you think, well, why should I have just had everything? I've just got what I wanted. I've got the job I want, or I'm in the relationship I want, or I've got the house I want. And then why should I be depressed? And it may be because having got that, there's nothing more to aim for, and it doesn't provide what they'd hoped for. And so depression sets in. So it's not uncommon that it can come after something successful, but often it is more often it's after an actual loss. And a small loss might be a final straw. In our society today, loss of identity, loss of security are possibly big problems, and it may be that these are some of the reasons for the increase in depression. And one of the things that these kind of events or circumstances do is that they cause anxiety, fear, And there's a very close link between anxiety and depression. And in a study of studies, and it's looking at American children over a period of time between the 1950s and the 1990s, they reckoned that they could see a linear increase in anxiety among children, and that normal children in America in the 1980s were as anxious as psychiatric children in the 50s. If they looked at the rates of anxiety, that in a sense the normal level of anxiety that children experience is greater now. And that may be, it's a society problem, not just an individual one in a family or in a child. Brain areas, the areas of the brain that are associated with anxiety and fear are very, in a sense, integrated with the ones that are related to depression and to mood and emotion. So neurologically, it's very easy to see how one influences the other and how they work together. And antidepressants, particularly like the SSRIs, have quite a significant effect on anxiety as well as being antidepressants. They're almost interchangeable in their use for those things, so you can see there is quite a link. And I've done some, this is some of the symptoms that overlap between, you can see between anxiety and depression, there are quite a few symptoms that are common. Pure anxiety, maybe things like agoraphobia or being over alert, compulsive behavior tends to be more in the realm of anxiety disorders. Things that are just true of depression on its own, it tends to have low mood, loss of interest, suicidal ideation. But there are many things that are shared. You can see them there. Sorry, that's a loss of pleasure, a loss of pleasure, a loss of enjoyment of in what normally would give pleasure. Sorry, a medical word. And as I say, a lot of the things are shared. So there's quite a lot of overlap. And in children particularly, one of the, not the only factor, but a childhood neglect or abuse is a strong predisposing factor for adult depression and anxiety. And you can see that those things lead to insecurity in a child, to fear, apprehension. And that may lay down, I'm going to think of it like railway tracks, it lays down some patterns of response that may remain dormant for quite a while, but then an event or circumstances in adult life trigger off a response that goes down the same track as it did in childhood, resulting in an actual illness or a state of depression. So that may be part of the predisposing factor. And dealing with anxiety may be one of the factors that would help, one of the ways of actually addressing the risk of depression. There's a lot about dealing with stress and talk about stress in our society. And stress is associated with changes in hormones in the body, including particularly one called cortisol, which is a stress hormone that I don't know if you know anyone or you yourselves have ever taken steroids for asthma or other conditions, and you may know or may have observed that it can lead to changes in behavior and mood. So cortisol is although it's a hormone that affects the immune response and other physiological responses in the body, can also affect mood. So stress and cortisol, there are quite a few links between those, and that may be one of the mechanisms in which stress, things that cause us anxiety, help also to lead to depression. And the question may be asked is, why is it so hard to kind of be happy? But one of the important factors in helping people get out of depression, in a sense, is the support of others and being able to express what is happening. And so, as well as individuals dealing with things like stress and so on, there are ways in which we can help someone with depression, not just getting them to see the doctor or the psychologist or the nurse, but or a counselor or the pastor, but also being there for support. And this came from an article, I think, in the briefing about how to help someone, a friend with depression, is recognizing that it exists. And I think we've had, this is a very good example of recognizing that the problem does exist, that you've come this morning prepared to talk about it in a Christian setting, because in many churches it's sort of, the idea is that Christians shouldn't suffer from depression, but in fact that isn't so, and we need to be able in our churches as well as in society in general to recognize that it does exist and that people do experience it, and that a person, that's what they may be going through. Giving it a name is helpful sometimes. Not always, but as I say, sometimes for people to say, yes, I am depressed, rather than, oh, I'm just reacting badly, or this is just too much, can be very helpful. It isn't helpful if they get stuck in that, but it can be helpful for it to be acknowledged. Prayer, as always, encourage them. Be patient. Depression is something that for relatives or carers can be very difficult to live with. The person who's depressed may seem uninterested, may seem withdrawn, and to maintain friendship, to maintain interest, to be patient can be difficult. So sometimes the carers need support, and that's where it comes in as well, supporting the person who's caring for someone with depression, and practical help. And that's remember, it's all going to fade away. Maybe a spiritual comfort ultimately, but also in terms of depression, depression will of itself naturally get better eventually, usually. There's a lot of ifs and buts in that, but in the natural progression of depression is to usually get better. But as I said before, some people can have more recurrent or chronic depression, and sometimes, of course, depression is severe enough, or people with a predisposition become suicidal, and that is one of the big risks of depression. In a sense, for me as a psychiatrist, I'm not dealing like a surgeon or an anaesthetist or a physician with matters of life and death in that sense of people, something that I do, an operation people may not recover from, but the risk of suicide is the one that I have to deal with. And I see families and so on affected very greatly by a loved one taking their own life, and see people who have done it. And so suicide is a significant risk. It's not a risk in every case of depression. Not everyone with depression is suicidal, but it is there, and it's something that therefore also to be taken seriously, not to be forgotten that it can be fatal. But as I say, on the whole, the good news is that depression can be treated and often improved, and that it largely will eventually get better. So giving hope is important. Giving, as I say, these were prepared, so I'll just go through them quick, for a women's group. Sometimes I wish someone who understands me would tell me what I mean. Support is important, and sometimes a good leader needs energy, wisdom, patience, and every so often a bit of a lie down. We need that. But above all, we need to give hope, and that is what will help people with depression to get through. It's not just knowing that they're taking pills or that they're going through CBT, but that there is a hope that they will get better. Okay. I want to do some case studies, but I'll give a few minutes maybe at this point for questions. My aim is to get you into groups to do some case studies, and after coffee to talk, to come back with those and discuss them a little bit, so that might also give you a chance to air questions and so on, and then to have a look a little bit towards the end at just some more spiritual aspects in terms of some of the biblical examples and so on. So that's kind of how the rest of the morning will go. But are there any questions now that people would like to ask, anything I didn't explain properly or that you have? Yeah. So.
People who've got predisposing factors from the past, from maybe their childhood, do you personally address that?
You asked if people have predisposing factors from their childhood do address it. I think that that's what I mentioned. Besides CBT, other forms of psychotherapy are sometimes used in the treatment of depression, not usually in the initial stages, but sometimes people do go to see counsellors. I think that, yes, it's sometimes necessary to look at what happened in the past, because there's probably, there can be an unhelpful dwelling on the past and saying, well, this happened to me, and just acknowledging that it happened may not necessarily bring any kind of healing. But sometimes recognizing what happened, being able to forgive, being able to even acknowledge it and then let go of it, if people can do that, it's not an easy thing to do. And I'm not a psychotherapist. I've done some psychotherapy and work with psychotherapists. So, and I remember one of my teachers saying, you know, insight does not necessarily bring change. Just because you understand what has happened, it doesn't necessarily mean that you can change how you feel about it. And I think that is where, in a sense, we have, as Christians, an immense advantage. It doesn't mean we're immune, but that we believe in forgiveness. We believe in healing. We believe in a God who can... the past isn't a barrier to God, and that so we can... Sometimes helping people to understand what has happened in the past and to come to terms with that is helpful. So, yes, I think that it does at times need to be addressed. For some people, though, they are very aware of what's happened in the past, but it feels to them that it's the here and now that's important, and that may be what they want to address more. So I think every individual should have a chance to look at what might be important and see what they want to do about it. Yeah.
Is it more likely that if somebody has had a mixture of events that's caused them to go into a depression, that they're more likely to come out of it than go into a chronic depression or recurrent?
Well, there's some argument about that. One of the, I think that often, I mean, if depression results from a life event and then life changes, then they may get better almost without medication or any help. Sometimes what happens, and I've seen it, is that particularly a major depression, a sort of severe depression, if it's triggered by an event, it takes, particularly if it recurs, it takes less and less to trigger it off. For some people, they then become, it almost takes on a life of its own, is the way some of us describe it, that it becomes then something that is not triggered by any big event, but actually can happen fairly easily. For some people, if it's triggered by a big event, and it may not then come back. But there are often a number of factors you look at. For example, someone with a family history is more likely to have it again, or someone with who's very isolated may be more likely to have it again. So there are number of factors involved. Okay, so what I would suggest, I've got 5 case studies. If you could, what I would like you to do is to get into groups of 6 or 7 or so and discuss these. If we could, I'll maybe go around, start at different points on the 5 studies, that we cover them all. I apologize that each one starts with a woman's name, but there are men in them, and because they were prepared for initially a woman's group, but there are men mentioned in them as well, so don't be put off by that. And if you would just have a look at the question, is what might be the factors contributing to the problem, and how could this person be helped, and is there anything the church could do contribute to this, and have a discussion about them, and then we'll come back after coffee and kind of feedback and have a chat together about these cases. Okay. I remember Marjorie Foyle, who helped to start InterHealth, saying that when she came back, she was putting a chicken out on the balcony and wrapping it in tinfoil and putting it high up. And somebody said, what are you doing with that? She said, it's the rats. She said, they said, well, there aren't any rats in London. High five, ice block. You know, they'd come from India. And somebody went away and was back fairly shortly, and 10p coins had been introduced in their absence, and they hadn't a clue what they were, or didn't know what cashback was when they were asked about it in the supermarket the first time. What's cashback? You know, things that, yeah, so life has changed for Sarah. What other ways has life changed for her? Yeah. I'll tell you in a moment, okay. What has she lost? What would you say? I mean, those things. What losses can you see in her life? Yeah, she's lost her status, her sense of identity, maybe a status as a missionary. She's now kind of not got such a well-defined role anymore. And I would imagine that coming back to be a supply teacher in the UK at the age of 52 is no easy task. So feeling maybe a loss of feeling worthwhile, feeling useful, in a loss of competence, feeling incompetent because struggling to control a classroom where you were actually functioning well as a missionary overseas. So, yeah, so there's that. Any other losses?
She also lost her Christian work.
Maybe, yes, yeah.
Yeah.
If you think of it in those terms, somebody, and this may be somebody who does, then, because she seems to have a fairly, I don't know, rigid view of what being a Christian is about. You know, it's not a wrong view, but she's fairly set in her view, and so there may be that. Yes, yeah, she's lost her father. That's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and sometimes, you know, loss is not something that hits people straight away. It can be delayed, and often if you're in a situation where you can't grieve for whatever reason, then the grieving happens at another time when it seems to be possible to grieve. So delayed grief. So she's lost her father. So she's lost, and she's lost her home. In that sense, and. If it may have been overseas. So there are a lot of losses, maybe others that you can think of. Okay. Yeah, well, she may feel she's losing her relationship with God as well, and that's something that the depression... So would you tell her to read the Bible more and pray more, or...? What would you tell her? Yeah. They will have, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think she probably needs to feel that she belongs, that there's some people to whom she belongs and who are supporting her. And maybe to be reassured that she hasn't lost her Christian faith. She's not no longer a Christian because of these things, but that it may be helpful to understand that those can be part of depression, and somebody explaining that if you're depressed, this is often the case may be a help. Would you suggest that she takes antidepressants? How would you help her think about it? I mean, would you... about how, what questions should she ask herself, or should? Yeah, go ahead. All right.
Maybe just if she's having
like helping someone to see that Christians can suffer from depression, and that's not a fault, and it's not wrong to take treatment for depression if that's what's needed. It may be that if some other things come in and change in life happens, then she may feel better without them, but that it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to take them if that's what happened.
Okay.
Is there anything else about Sarah that you want to? Okay.
We wanted getting someone in the church to meet with her, to help her pray,
And sometimes saying, well, one verse is enough, you know, that's as much as you don't have to read 10 chapters and a commentary as well. You know, you can just read a verse, or that's still reading God's word and still feeding yourself with God's word, or listen, you know, there are other ways to do it. It doesn't have to be rigid. It may well be that would be a great deal of help. Mm. And sorry, you were going to say. I think that often is a help to understand that, and I think often to understand that these are normal reactions, that for someone whose life has changed so much in a short period of time and experienced these losses, that kind of reaction is in a sense normal. It's not, she's not weird, she's not a failure, but that's a normal kind of reaction that you might expect, and that therefore that can give sometimes people hope that, yeah, okay, it's actually not all right to feel like this, in the sense that it's a good feeling, but it is okay. It's permissible. And somebody think that for Christians, it is permissible. Sorry, Junior.
Yeah, Evan, you've put that the symptoms have lasted 2 months. Mm-hmm. This is a question for you, really, and you know more than GPs. Is after 2 months an appropriate time to start antidepressants? Or should it be a bit longer with a cluster of symptoms like this?
Well, the DSM qualification is 2 weeks. So within the DSM, it says if you've had these symptoms persistently for 2 weeks, provided it's not within the period after an actual bereavement. So that's quite a short period of time. For someone who's very anti-antidepressants, I'd sometimes not try to force them into taking them, because taking antidepressants isn't a completely benign process, in a sense. They're not smarties, or they are quite powerful drugs. They make people sometimes feel quite agitated, maybe sick, nauseated to start with. So if they take them and they feel bad, immediate reaction will be, can't take these, and they stop them. And that's not going to help them anyway. So, and although it may not affect Sarah so much, it may not be a factor, but for many people, antidepressants, SSRIs, affect sexual functioning. They can affect sexual feelings even, so that can be distressing for anyone, but they can also affect performance. And so for many people, they're not necessarily just a drug to take lightly, and if you're not prepared to kind of persist with them, then they're not going to do any good. So it's no point in sort of forcing her a packet of tablets on her that she's going to go home, take one or two, feel horrible, and then say, well, I can't take these anyway, so there you go. You need someone's commitment to taking them, and they need to be taken for for one episode, the sort of standard therapy is that you take them for at least 4 months after you've got better. You advise people to take them for a four-month period following recovery so that you reduce the risk of relapse. And you're committing people to at least 6 months probably of treatment, usually. It doesn't always happen, but so I think you might want to help her with other things first, and then say, well, look, if your symptoms are going on and they've gone on this long, why not give it a go, but you need to take them for at least a month or probably quite a few months, really, to stay well. Okay, shall we move on to Bob and Josephine? What, any thoughts about this couple?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's probably in this situation, although it's fairly clear that Bill needs treatment. Josephine is the one who needs, at the moment, much of the support and help. Yeah, sorry. ECT is a treatment that under the law has to either be given with consent or in terms of the Mental Health Act, you have to have if the person doesn't consent, you have to have a second opinion that says that it's needed. So there are certain safeguards around the giving of ECT that it just isn't one doctor giving everybody ECT. But for severe depression, particularly in older people, it is often one of the most effective treatments, and it works quickly, so it relieves a lot of distress. And if you've got someone who isn't eating and drinking, who's in danger of dying from dehydration, then it's a life-saving treatment. So, but if the person is not capable of giving consent, if either they're too unwell to really understand everything that's going on and therefore they haven't the capacity to give consent, or they're ill, mentally ill, but refusing, then the Mental Health Act needs to be used with all the kind of requirements that that has for other doctors, social workers, assessment, and the rights of appeal that there are for people against it. So, yeah.
I just wondered whether someone like Josephine would actually be the person who would carry all the weight of that.
Well, no, she can't give the consent to the ECT on his behalf. The way the Mental Health Act works currently, people who are admitted for assessment under Section 2 can don't need, it's just two doctors and a social worker, and regardless of kind of, you don't have to have a relative's consent or so on. But for the treatment under the Mental Health Act, which is the Section 3, a relative has to give consent to that. They don't have to sign anything. They don't sign them in or anything, but they do have to, if they disagree with them being sectioned, then the section can't go ahead unless a legal process has gone through of displacing that person as the relative and so on. So it's quite a procedure. So Josephine's consent to him being sectioned would need to be given, because it would have to be under Section 3 in order for him to be treated with ECT. So she'd have to at least give her consent to it. But the treatment and so on, that would be then the doctor's decision, and she doesn't have to sign anything to say he can have it. It's done outside, apart from her. And I think in my experience, often when people get better from depression, they're very grateful they've had the treatment and they're okay again, and they don't hold a grudge against the person. I mean, a lot of people who are sectioned for other reasons do hold grudges about the people who've done it, particularly in delusion. You know, if they don't believe they're ill at all, then they can be very angry with whoever sectioned them. And but often if it's depression, when people then start to feel better, and then they're glad that they had the treatment and they can understand. So
is it quite common for people that have Alzheimer's and or have had a stroke, several strokes, to slip into a depression?
The quick answer to that is yes, probably it is. Sometimes depression can be the presenting symptom of dementia. So sometimes older people start off being depressed, and it becomes quite clear that actually they're starting to lose their memory and other things are going. The difficulty is that depression and dementia can look very like each other, and it can be hard to tell. So sometimes you have to treat for the depression first and then see, and it turns out that actually there's underlying memory difficulty. Sometimes there's not. It's the memory difficulty is part of the difficulties of concentration and remembering that are part of the depression. So in older people, that's one of the big differentiations that psychiatrists are trying to make, and to try and make sure that people aren't just written off, oh, this is dementia, so therefore they don't need any treatment, when in fact it's depression and they will get better. But sometimes it is the presenting symptom. And people with any kind of if blood vessels to the brain aren't supplying the brain with enough nutrition and the brain cells are dying off, then depression may be part of that. So people with strokes are more likely to get depressed as well.
Are we assuming in this case that ECT is the last resort?
Well, I think I would just put that in because a third episode that isn't, you know, that's recurring and is quite severe, then presumably he has had other treatments and they haven't worked. So he wouldn't use ECT unless, and there are some people who very quickly slip into a very withdrawn state for which ECT is the only treatment that will work quickly. And if that's known, you might go quite quickly to ECT. But for most people, it's usually when other treatments have not worked. So it's not the kind of first thing. Okay, move on to Kath and Phil, where she seems to be having a sort of what may be a postnatal depression. But what factors do you think might be going on here? Yeah. I think, many feel that's very true. I think that's very, very true about expectations. And quite often people are led to believe that they can, in a sense, have it all. They should be successful at work and successful at home and manage everything without turning a hair and still look wonderful, you know, and get their figure back in 2 days. And that sort of pressure that's on, you know, to people can be unrealistic, or they can expect also to feel wonderful. You know, a new baby, everybody should feel absolutely wonderful. And if you feel a bit washed out or tired and not the joy that people say you're supposed to have, again, you can feel a failure because somehow you haven't achieved that. So, yeah, that's, I think, very important. Feeling that you have to be perfect, and afraid, you know, that if you're not, you will repeat what happened in your own family. And as we were saying earlier, it may be that someone with this background hasn't, although she's forgiven her parents in a Christian way, it may be that some of the emotion and fear and anger or whatever associated with her parents' breakup hasn't actually been acknowledged fully, and so in terms of its effect on her, and so some of that is coming back. And when you have a baby, it can be hard to realise that, you know, sometimes you feel you shouldn't be, you can't be vulnerable because you've got this child to look after. And if you're feeling vulnerable yourself, it can be hard to cope with that. Any words for Phil? Anything for him? Mm-hmm. Well, who did he marry?
Someone with a master's degree and someone who's a high flyer.
Yeah, he married someone who was presumably competent, seemed to cope with everything, had coped with her parents' divorce, got a master's degree, you know, was grand, and then suddenly she's weepy and struggling over a baby, you know. So he may find, have a real difficulty in saying, this is not the person I married, and I don't know how to react to her as she is now, because I've never known her like this. So, there was a very famous, she's only got one baby now, but a study in the Camberwell area that was done of looking a survey and finding that women at home with small children were a high risk group for depression, because they often are quite isolated, and they don't have they're stuck with dealing with that. So it's in itself it's recognised as an issue. Okay, so then what about Mary and her situation? Would you give her antidepressants?
CBD.
Maybe, yeah. Uh-huh. Anything else you would do for her? What do you think her main need is, in a sense, or what would you say the main? Yeah. Probably befriending, support, and a kind of maybe the thing that she is most in need of as she works through all that's happened. I mean, she's lost. She's suffered, in one sense, a bereavement, but a messy bereavement, because she's been... it's not... He's gone off with somebody else. He's hurt her, and it's not gone. It's not over, because the divorce may still have to be gone through if they're going to have one. There's all of that still... so it's a messy thing, and so... she's going to need support through a lot of that, and it may be that some of those things, and maybe some practical support, if he's gone and she's nobody to, I don't know, fix the shelf that's fallen down, those sorts of things may also be helpful, just to let her know that she's not completely on her own.
I think she needs to be allowed to be angry as well.
Yeah. Place where describing how she feels, yeah.
She seems to have, it's all manifested itself in kind of physical, her self-esteem, how she feels about herself physically, the dieting and trying to keep it in, that might be kind of masking what's a lot of deeper feelings about her own self-worth.
Yeah.
Confidence as her, you know, as a woman, as a person.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody to do that.
Yeah.
But also to help her
extent of her responsibility and the extent of his.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that we are accountable for our own actions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Regardless of that she, that it is a false guilt.
Yeah, maybe.
That she's feeling. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's very true. And guilt is a quite a common symptom in depression. People often feel guilty. And one of the difficulties trying to... I think one of the ways in which sometimes Christians fear psychotherapy is that they fear that it will kind of tell them that they're not to blame for everything. Everybody else is to blame, and that they... it doesn't acknowledge that any role for kind of sin, and maybe telling them to go and do things that they feel are would be wrong in order to feel better. You know, because you go and have an affair, go and do this because that will make you feel better about yourself. And Christians fear that that's not good psychotherapy if it does that sort of thing. But one of the things that needs to be distinguished between is appropriate guilt and false guilt. The kind of guilt that says you're to blame for things that actually are not your responsibility or not your fault, while at the same time knowing that we are sinners in need of forgiveness from God. So, and getting that balance right is quite difficult. I'm sure it must be easy for preachers have to preach the truth and at the same time be aware that members of their congregation may take it inappropriately personally. And so people need a regular, in a sense, they need regularly to hear the word of God to get the full truth and to be able to learn how to apply it to themselves so that they can distinguish between, as I say, this false sense of guilt and appropriate guilt. So that's a difficult one sometimes. I mean, and it's something that Mary needs help with because she's obviously taken on herself all the guilt of what's happened. And maybe some of it is anger that she's actually manifesting a sort of guilty type reactions, but she's taking that on, and I need to help with offloading that rather than carrying it. Okay, finally, we just go to Jeff and Phil.
What? Presumably, if she was counseled, the counselor, it would be useful if the counselor explored with her whether there was anything in this claim that she let herself go and it's no fun to be with. So that's going a bit against what you just said, but I mean,
it might be, but I think that's probably in this situation wouldn't be too helpful to address straight away. It might be something for marital, if they decide to come reconcile. It might be something that needs to be explored in the sense, as long as it's not again pointing the finger at her and saying, well, you know, if you'd looked better after yourself better, he wouldn't have done what he did. It has to be explored much more sensitively than that. So, but it might come to be recognised that actually, yeah, she did focus more on kind of the house and the children, and he didn't work at the marriage, but then he may not have encouraged her to do that either. He might have been quite happy to have somebody doing all the housework and everything, and only at a midlife crisis, found somebody to make him feel better about himself and went off with her instead. So it would need to be sensitively explored, but I think at this stage, But I think false reassurance is no help to anyone, so it's trying to be truthful and at the same time supportive. Okay, and Jeff and Fiona? Mm-hmm.
In this case, it seems to be reversed. He doesn't seem to be very happy. And is he working all the hours there are because he can't come? Is it to keep away from the family?
Mm-hmm.
Are there issues there that is needed? Or is he being pushed by the family to have his promotion, to get more money, to get more things? There's another pressure there. That's not said, really. So, I suppose Fiona's been trying to speak, but typically where he is, he's something. So he hasn't opened up on that, and it's a bit of a one-sided situation. But especially from Fiona's point of view, is that since what basis you've got for things on the internet, sort of, you know, pornography, and also your alcoholic father, how's that suddenly thrown itself up?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem to be correlated to, completely to the situation. Is she over anxious about nothing? Or is there something to worry about? I suppose it's what we're not told.
I was just raising a number of possible factors, not saying that they will absolutely are the factors, but there are possibilities.
Well, the fact that the father's alcoholism does make you wonder if there's some inherited trait, some kind of addictive personality, which might relate to the concerns about the internet.
Yes, the addictive kind of tendencies can be inherited, so that may be something that he's doing rather than drinking, but he's using pornography. I mean, sometimes wives come across it accidentally by looking at where the last site visited or something, or a pop-up or something, and they discover it, or a bill, or
they're having a different bedtime, which perhaps is a way of growing apart, you know,
mm-hmm. Well, I think some of the ways that people do that can be helpful for anyone, but often is groups who address these issues not as your problem, but we as men or men share this, and looking at, so that gives a forum where it may be easier to actually share it without necessarily saying I've got this problem, but acknowledging that it can be a problem for men, that they can share in that way. Sometimes on the whole men, it seems to be, but men find it easier sometimes to talk about things when they're doing something with somebody rather than sitting eye to eye. You know, how are you feeling today? You know, they don't. Fine. You know, don't talk to me like that. I don't want that. Tell me. But if they're working with somebody on fixing the car or something, or playing, you know, may be more willing to speak. Men can sometimes get alongside to invite them for, not for a cup of coffee across, you know, to divulge your secrets, but actually to go and play a game of golf or badminton, or, you know, or and get alongside, and that may work better. So it's knowing what works for different groups, and as I say, sometimes a group that meets, that looks at God's word and then looks at how that applies to men's lives in terms of work, in terms of sex, in terms of relationship, those sorts of things can be also helpful. Any other? Yeah.
The response I find seems to be a kind of blocking to any discussion about his activities.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that there is the sexual relationship is one which involves her, and that maybe she could focus on that and say, okay, you're fine, but I'm not fine about this particular area.
It might be. That might be a way. There's no, I think, easy answer or single one right answer for this. But I think what I'm perhaps indicating in this study is that the presentation, something Jeff is having problems, but it doesn't present to him saying I'm feeling rough or I'm struggling. It's showing itself in other ways, and it might be that the promotion is one promotion too many for him. He can't cope with this new level of responsibility, or it might be that he was looking forward to it and it isn't what he hoped it would be, so he's disappointed. It may be that he's coming to a time in his life when he's thinking, well, what's the point of this work? You know, what is my life about? And trying to find, not really able to address that, but then looking for other things to fill the gap or fill the feeling. So is that okay? Anyone want to raise any other burning issues. Okay. Thank you for your participation. Okay, I know. Just wanted to close, really. I know we've touched on the spiritual aspect of depression a bit as we've gone through, because I don't think you can put them in separate boxes and say this is the sickness, this is spiritual, this is social. They all and link in, and spiritual is probably at the core of things in a way, of everything. But depression always, I think, has a spiritual aspect, whether people acknowledge it or not. Not because it always has a spiritual cause as such, but it affects people's spiritual life. It may make them think about what life means. It may also make it more difficult to have the normal Christian experience that they think. It might make coming to church difficult. There are all those kind of things. Because when Christians become depressed, they often do find it hard to have any sense of God's presence. Concentration on Bible study and prayer can become difficult, if not impossible. And feeling that God is there can be very difficult. It can seem that just there's nothing, or worse, if God has turned his back on them. And so I was talking about, in severe depression that is associated with psychosis, or not even quite as far as that, there can be this sense in the belief that God has abandoned them. William Cooper, the poet and hymn writer, and he sort of, at times in his severest depression, believed that there was salvation, but not for him. And people who sometimes, I remember as a medical student working, being allocated to a lady with depression who was a Christian, and I struggled greatly with it because she kept on saying, well, yeah, but that applies to everybody else, but it doesn't apply to me. I can't repent. I think I've committed the unforgivable sin, and no amount of my earnest efforts as a Christian medical student could help her see it differently. And it floored me quite severely, in fact, that I thought maybe psychiatry wasn't the field I should take, because I just couldn't help this person at all. So in the severest depression, as I say, it can feel like God is not there, or not that God is not there, but that God is there for everybody else, but not for the person themselves. So, and then there's also the guilt of feeling like this. Christians shouldn't, or it's not a very good advert for the gospel, or I ought to be happy, or it says, you know, that the teaching is Christians are always happy, or they're always joyful, and I'm not, so therefore I can't be a very good Christian. They say that's why the Christian CBT book, I think they've titled it, I'm Not Supposed to Feel Like This, because that's so often what Christians say. But on the other converse, that sometimes depression is the thing that leads a person to look for a different way of life. So some people will say, you know, before I became a Christian, I was very low. I was looking for something, I didn't know what, but I felt terrible. And then I became a Christian and suddenly earth above is sweeter blue, or earth around is sweeter green, and things look better when you become a Christian. That is the experience for some people, but it's not for everyone. Working through the CBT kind that I mentioned, the cognitive behavior therapy kind of approach, can identify thought patterns that are not just unhelpful, but that are actually wrong. And Romans 12, Paul talks about having our minds renewed, and Philippians, he talks about thinking about things that are good and true. So there's an awful lot more in the Bible about how we think and about the things we think about and how we think. But as I said, we have to be careful of treading the line between making the individual feel that he or she is completely to blame for the way that they are, and helping them recognize and address wrong patterns of thinking. So it's not always an easy line to tread, but people do need to be able to address and recognize their thinking patterns. Somebody mentioned about depression in the Bible and the examples, and my question is there depression in the Bible? And I think you can read different books and decide different things about whether there's depressive illness as such in the Bible, but I think there is enough about low mood and symptoms that might suggest that the Bible has got things to say about depression. But which biblical passages actually do or not don't describe it sometimes is open to debate. But it's, I think it's very clear that anxiety, anyway, and fear are part of our fallen state. Adam's first reaction in the Garden of Eden was to God was, "I was afraid." Saw God and he was afraid. And a kind of, like a holy fear was replaced by a shameful fear. And that stayed with us to some extent. We have still that tendency. In Deuteronomy, the children of Israel were told that if they didn't go God's way, they would experience a trembling heart and failing eyes and a languishing soul. Your life shall hang in doubt before you. Night and day you shall be in dread and have no assurance of your life. In the morning you shall say, "If only it were evening," and at evening you will say, "If only it were morning," because of the dread that your heart shall feel and the sights that your eyes shall see. Again, that's not a passage to give to an individual and say, "Here you are." Obviously, your sin has caused your state, but as part of us, we are susceptible to those kind of things in the state of the fallenness and rebellion against God that there is in the world.
Could you give us the
reference? Sorry, that's Deuteronomy 28 and 64 following. I was finding it in 1 Samuel where 21, where David feigns madness before Abimelech, then Achish, the king of Gath. He struck me that in those days, madness was recognized. There was something recognized as mental illness, whether it was exactly the same as what we would. They knew that he was mad and therefore not responsible for what he was doing. David, the psalm that seems to... that probably goes with that is Psalm 34. And if you look at Psalm 34, where David is describing how it says of David when he changed his behavior before Abimelech, he describes feeling quite low. And presumably, in a sense, if he's written it at this time, this was what David himself was experiencing. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him. He was feeling quite bereft, quite low. He talked about being broken hearted. In verse 18, he talks about the Lord is near to the broken hearted and saves the crushed in spirit. And if that psalm was written at that time when David was in that place in his life, then that is presumably how he felt, broken hearted and crushed in spirit, afflicted. So I think that there, although he feigned madness, he was going through a very real experience of being in trouble, low and anxious. Elijah is often quoted as an example of depression, his experience after Mount Carmel. I don't know if any of you read Dale Ralph Davies, but his commentary on this chapter of 1 Kings 19 is, "Let not the psychotherapists win." He doesn't want this to be an analysis of Elijah's psychological condition in the sense of saying that he was just suffering from depression. I tend to agree. When you see all that Elijah went through, not that his response is he was a perfect man, but the heights of kind of spiritual experience, of physical threat that he was under, exhaustion, huge emotional intensity, huge spiritual intensity of a spiritual battle. I think it's hardly surprising that Elijah was exhausted in every way. He was done out and worn out. And God's care of him is a wonderful example of restoring him in every which way, both in terms of physical restoration, sleep and food, in terms of emotional restoration. He was given time to express, "What are you doing here, Elijah? Tell me." And he had an opportunity to express what he was feeling, what he'd gone through, and God listened to him. God then gently told him some other things that were also true, but he gave him the opportunity to say what he was had gone through and restored him and then sent him out again. So I think that this is an example of good care for people who are stressed and a good encouragement to us, and also helpful to realize that after periods of great spiritual intensity, maybe for preachers or ministers of the word or other people who give out hugely at one time, there may be a subsequent reaction, and that is not abnormal. It can something that can be sometimes even expected. So you can maybe decide for yourself whether you think Elijah was suffering from depression or not, but he's still got a lot to tell us about care for people and about how God cares for us in the way we feel. Psalm 42 and 43, that was like it was one psalm, are also a fairly good psalms for being cast down. The recurrent theme is hope in God, you know, for I shall again praise him. So the hope theme is there throughout, but there's also the pouring out of how the person feels in all their distress, in all their questioning, and also at talking to themselves, which is often depression. Somebody says, talk. We need not to talk always to other people, but also to talk to ourselves, to tell ourselves the things that are true. So talking to ourselves. John Piper refers to a thing called gutsy guilt, which he says is the kind of reaction that fights to apply forgiveness, that actually struggles, works hard at applying these truths to our own lives. And so, say Psalm 42 and 43 has got that. The Psalm says, why are you cast down, O my soul? Why are you in turmoil within me? Hope in God. So the psalmist is talking to themselves about God and struggling to remember the good things about God while at the same time feeling that all the breakers and waves have gone over them, that they're being overwhelmed by what's happening, by how they're feeling as well. And I referred earlier to William Cooper. He throughout his life struggled with depression and probably actually died in a state of quite severe depression. And he made suicidal attempts. But he wrote in his poem that we sing as a hymn, sometimes God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He says, judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. And there are other examples of Christians, many of them, Spurgeon, a consultant pediatrician that I heard speak recently, who's written a lot about medical ethics, who himself went through a very severe depression. And as I said, Marjorie Foyle, who's written her autobiography recently, a psychiatrist who worked many years in India and then came back and helped to found InterHealth. There are many, many, many more examples of people who have found that God is still there, even though depression may seem to hide him and may be a difficult experience to go through. We have a God in whom we can hope. Thank you.
Thank you, Evelyn. I think we all really appreciate the sensitive way and the expert and insightful way that you've really dealt with this subject, which is so tender. And we really appreciate your time, the way you've poured yourself into it.